Well, if you're not feeling it yet, there's something wrong. Good morning. I'm truly delighted to be with you, and thank you for the invitation. It is good to be together, to partner together, to quit acting like we need to do everything by ourselves in these little congregations, to actually compare notes, to speak with one another, to share ministries, and to borrow from one another. To talk a little this morning about recreation stories. Where do we come from? Where are we going? 2 years ago, in Joshua Tree National Park, you may know of that place in Southern California, I listened intently as the park ranger told me about how the land evolved over time and about how the more recent two-legged characters had inhabited it. I worked really hard, to imagine myself having ever called that terrain home. If you've been there, you may know what I mean. Even in the spring, the desert has a beauty that only in the last handful of years has my eye been able to recognize. You see, the harshness of my Midwestern winters may be difficult, but her gentle rolling hills and lush green through spring and summer offers a softness that nurtures my spirit still, even at this distance. Yet I am able now to see and celebrate the beauty of the desert, and even if I am unable to imagine what it must have been like to cross it on horseback, let alone be imaginative enough to stake a claim there. It was these thoughts that accompanied me as I walked a trail through the park, unusually, and you know, there's still a movement to kick me out of Unitarian Universalism for this, but unusually, I stopped on that trail to read each informational sign. I know that's a common faith hazard, but it's not my tendency. And on that walk, one sign in particular struck me. It said this, that the miners and freighters, that is to say those workers passing through in search of fortune or simply a better life, would plant cottonwood trees. Now hear that. This wasn't the residents. This wasn't the folks who had staked a claim. These were the folks who were on their way through, who didn't necessarily plan and certainly couldn't expect to come through that way again. Still, they would plant cottonwood trees so that those who came next would be able to find more shade than they had found. Wow. I don't know about you. I love our national parks. I like to think of myself as a solid patron and a good citizen. I take only pictures. I leave only footprints. Yada, yada. And yet, when I read that plaque, I realized I don't think about creating something, about growing something for the next folks. Oh, sure, I do. I think a smidge about maintaining and preserving, but not actually about improving. I'm not thinking about how I can leave it better for someone else. I'm chagrined to admit that I am not by nature thinking of who comes next in a very deep way. Sure, like I said, I get it when it comes to traveling lightly, to minimizing my negative impact on the environment. But that piece, That piece about creating something that will have a positive impact on the nameless and the faceless? Nope. I don't do much of that. And I want to defend myself, especially to you folks who don't know me. I want to give you a good impression. I want to defend myself. I want to say, oh, but I give money to the national parks with the purchase of my annual passes and my taxes and my occasional extra check in the mail for some specific request. Or I want to say, and here I might be getting a little desperate, after I'm gone, my stuff will go to folks I don't know because some of it is going to family, heirs I haven't yet met, and some of it's going to institutions, and I don't know all of the people in them now, and certainly I won't know all of them between now and when I die, let alone after I die. So, I mean, doesn't that count for something? I want to say all of that and more. I mean, it's pretty normal. I bet a lot of us in this room could say the same thing. And yet, after Joshua Tree, my travels took me to San Diego, and again, this part in me was confronted. Now, if you've been to San Diego, and this was my first time there, you have likely been to a place in it called Balboa Park. Yeah? It's huge. Huge. 1,440 acres. Huge. Real estate value, most of us couldn't touch in a lifetime if we partnered with our partner's partners. From humble beginnings of chaparral and scrub brush, there was loved into being, a botanical masterpiece of diverse, drought-resistant plants and trees. And it is stunning. It is beautiful. And on those grounds, there are museums, there's green spaces, and a world-famous zoo. Now, San Diego, like most of this country, was resettled by European Americans who largely applied their rules to tilt the balance in their favor in procuring land. San Diego was populated by Mexicans, since it was part of Mexico, when whites arrived and began redirecting water flow to convert desert into more hospitable land. With its steady temperatures, low humidity, and revised natural beauty, it is not surprising that people found it and continue to find it a desirable place to live. And yet, for all its desirability and the certainty of all its business folks that it would be a profitable place to set up shop, San Diego set aside all of those acres within its city limits for a park. With only 2,300 residents at the time, it decided to create a park to rival Central Park in New York City. Though at the time, San Diego lacked the profile and emerging world importance. If all of that weren't enough, 60 years later, another businessman gifted land to the city, which has now been converted into something called the Presidio, also large acreage beauty. See, in these stories, I cannot help but see people who inhabit their vision, who just get in there and live it. In Joshua Tree, folks passing through believe that they are treading the path to adventure and financial freedom. They know others will follow, and they want life to be easier on them. In San Diego, there is a vision of a city that does not yet exist. New York with better weather all the time. Let's not just create the businesses and then bring in the people. Let's plan the city that we want to live in. Let's create more beauty and let's hold it in the public interest. My goodness. And I wonder, what has happened to us? What has happened to us? Do any of us think like this anymore? And we can justify why we don't. We can say all that kind of land has been purchased and spoken for already. We can make all kinds of excuses. Yet, I'll be honest with you. I think we have changed as people. I do. And while I want to believe personally that I am different than our culture, I see in these stories that I am a part of it. My imagination seems stunted when it comes to generously providing for the future. I have an attitude of giving primarily based on how it impacts me and mine, giving in direct proportion to how I witness that it benefits me and mine. Now, sometimes I wonder what it would have been like to be a pioneer, leaving aside for a moment the arrogance of our European ancestors that they were entitled by God or king to settle this already inhabited land. I still wonder what would it have been like. It is hard to look back. It's hard to look back and not be impacted by the privileges I now enjoy. By that I mean, when I look back, when I try to look back, I can easily believe I would have felt like an oddball in the crowd. You may have read about such people. I would have been constrained by social norms with which I didn't agree and didn't fit, and I would have longed to go someplace else. I can easily believe I would have had the motivation to move into the imagined vast possibilities of the West. Yet when I think about enduring the realities of moving across unfamiliar terrain with all its physical challenges, needing to hunt, riding endlessly on horseback or in a wagon, the wide range of temperatures, the wind, the rain, not to mention the isolation and the boredom, I cannot picture me in it. Again, I want to. I want to believe I am strong and capable, and that if I wanted it, nothing would have gotten in my way. But if I am honest, I struggle to imagine myself enduring. And if somehow I did endure, I did make it, it is really difficult to think I would be thinking of others. Of others, who might come next. But I think that's what I and that's what we are asked to do. All the time. Not just by minimizing the harm that I cause or we cause, but by engaging in what might make it easier for those who come next. To hold and inhabit a vision in which I contribute my gifts and my talents by proactive acts of creation so that those who follow me will find shade or have green space or beauty to enjoy, or maybe, just maybe, so those who come after me will have a place that they won't have to say they drove by for years and wondered what was here. That, why didn't they hear about Unitarian Universalism earlier in their life? Who knew religion could be like this? Who knew that a place like this, one, that will accept us and love us who we are, as we are, not in spite of who we are. This congregation is your creation. Now, I understand none of you were here in the 1890s. Even Mark, I understand, confessed a few weeks ago he was not actually in attendance when Lincoln was inaugurated a second time. So I'm doubting that he made it here by 1890s. And yet this congregation is made anew, is shaped and recreated by each of you as you join. Benedictine nun Joan Chittister claims that recreation is a part of a spirituality of balance. In fact, she says, recreation is the virtue that sends us off to cleanse the palate of our souls from that which had us in knots yesterday. In recreation, we find that which renews the essence of our being and helps us see life and all its possibilities anew. A place where we can renew our sense of possibility, a place that will be our legacy, a place that will provide shade, shelter, and life-giving habitat for those who follow us. See, it has everything to do with us and nothing at all for each of us. We are only temporary inhabitants here in this congregation and on this planet. This call to recreation is what guides me as I evaluate my own financial pledge to my congregation. And I encourage you all to look at it that way too. Now, I understand this is not how our culture teaches us to give, right? I understand that it is particularly not how giving to one's faith community is modeled. And I also understand that for many of us, the idea of money and church is a flashback to the 1980s and the excesses of so-called religious empires built by slick promises and overly made up celebrity preachers. I understand that religion and money are things we're told not to talk about in polite company. But my friends, my partners, in a community where you say you want to be holders of hope and love's people, where you say you've got something so real and so important here, you want to transform the world through your social justice work, through the prayers of your hands and your feet, where you say you've got something to hold your children as they face playground bullying, hallway bigotry, and their own lives unfolding in this disconnected world steeped in fear and frustration. When you say all that, and I know you do because I've been reading and listening, then you've got to be able to talk about money. Because I promise you, if you do not talk about it, if you do not wrestle together through what your best selves envision and partner, then you will tread water. And likely you will keep from drowning, probably, but you will not accomplish anything together. You will save no one, not even yourself, and your shared epithet will read, "This was once a place that held nice people who found home and were held and dreamed big dreams but didn't want to talk or plan or practice ways in which to make their dreams come true." Now, maybe that's harsh. But sometimes naming hard things is important ministry. And that important ministry is being fabulously tended to by your stewardship team, led by Aaron and Aaron. You are doing good work here. I knew of only one other congregation before this one whose stewardship team gave out money at the offering. And it was magic. You turned 400 into 4,500. Look at what you are capable of. See, helping each other engage with what it really takes to not just tread water, but inhabit a vision and make it reality is our work. To push up our sleeves and work together so that sometime you can say, here. I was part of that. I paid for the dreams of my best self. I left it better than I found it. I thought about the folks who were coming next. I want that legacy for you. I want that for Unitarian Universalism. And here's the other thing. If we don't talk about it, if we don't teach each other, then that vacuum will be filled with messages by our culture. And those messages, friends, do not match our religious values. Messages that spring from a place of fear and shortage, and I gotta get mine. Messages that say, somebody else will take care of it. Messages that say, I'll give if and only if it's convenient and doesn't impact me. Maybe a story will best illustrate this. A few years ago, radio commentator Paul Harvey, you know the voice, shared a true story, I'm going to underscore that again, of a woman and her frozen Thanksgiving turkey. The Butterball Turkey Company set up a telephone hotline to answer consumer questions about preparing holiday turkeys. One woman called to inquire about cooking a turkey, and the person on the other end of the phone started to go into thawing the turkey and so forth, when the woman interrupted and she said, yes, but this turkey has been at the bottom of my freezer for 23 years. I beg your pardon, said the call representative. 23 years, she said. Is it still good? The representative told her the turkey would probably be safe to eat if the freezer had been kept below zero for each day, each hour of the 23 years. But the Butterball representative hastened to warn her that even if the turkey was safe to eat, the flavor would probably have deteriorated to such a degree that she just could not recommend eating it. The woman caller said, that's what I thought. Well, we'll give the turkey to our church. True story. 23-year-old turkey, the taste will probably be compromised. Golly, do you think? Yeah, but we don't want it, so hey, let's give it to the church. We got to give something. So let's give from what we don't want and what we would otherwise throw out. Now, I say this story with humility because my first pledge to a UU congregation was and is embarrassing. I knew nothing from my parents about how to pledge to a church. The financial commitment they continue to make to the Catholic Church in which I was raised will only be revealed after they are gone. All questions to penetrate this guarded secret have gone for naught. Moreover, my first Unitarian Universalist minister seemingly prayed for the earth to swallow her whole before she got to the part where she talked about money. So I filled out the pledge form with no thought. In retrospect, it is embarrassing. Believe me, it, multiplied by the small number of members we had, would have paid for nothing, sustained nothing, created nothing. And yet, I would have said with great certitude and complete passion, man, I love this church. See, it's easy and human to skate along the surface, to not attend to what's going on underneath. And yet, at times, the veil of our denial is pierced. And it's embarrassing to realize how much we took for granted. And I know this not only from being embarrassed in my church life, but in my home life. A few years into my relationship with my partner, Betsy, who is here this morning, so she knows this is coming. Few years into my relationship with her, we were out with some friends. It was social time, you know, just four folks having a little dinner, catching up with each other, having some laughs. And I don't remember now the content of the conversation, of course. Maybe we happened upon pet peeves or household chores. I don't know what led into it, but I do remember with crystal clarity my beloved Betsy saying, and I quote, "Wendy never fills the soap dispenser." Now, these were best friends, and they heard the charge in these words, and so they did what best friends do. They correct the joke and change the subject. So after some time, our evening ends, and we walk to the parking lot together, and as Betsy and I got into our car, I looked over at Betsy. I don't know why I'm not able to help myself. And I said, "Now, about that soap dispenser." And I got the look. Now, I know you don't know Betsy, but I'm pretty sure you know the look. "Don't even," she said. And I said, no, I'm not being defensive. If you can imagine, back in my lawyering days, I had a tendency to argue and be a little self-righteous. I'm certain those days are behind me. I just wanted to tell you about the soap dispenser, I said. I looked in it the other day. And as I put the top back on, I said to myself, "Dang, this thing is amazing. It never needs filling." It's a really proud moment for me to share with you. At that point, all Betsy could do was laugh. It is hard to be mad at someone that stupid. And I am humbled by my ignorance, and yet I see it as a common human enterprise. How often do any of us come to church and find it open when we get here? Do we think about who did that? We reach for the lights and voila, they come on. We need to be held when something has rocked our world, or we call for care. We need a worship service or a memorial service. We need to sing or be sung to. We need a place for our children. And it all appears. Whew. When did we stop thinking about how that happens? And when did we stop thinking about what it really might take for each of us to maintain it? And then do we consider how to make it better, how to improve it for the folks who are coming next, who need this place even more than we do right now? You know, Winston Churchill said, "You make a living from what you get, but you make a life from what you give." You make a life from what you give. And giving, like all things worthwhile, requires attention and intention. What kind of life are we creating by our gifts? How are we using our gifts? What are we creating? Poet David White offers guidance. "Be infinitesimal under that sky," he says. "A creature even the sailing hawk misses, a wraith among the rocks where the mists part slowly. Recall the way mere mortals are overwhelmed by circumstance, how great reputations dissolve with infirmity, and how you, in particular, live a hair's breadth from losing everyone you hold dear. And then look back down the path as if seeing your past, and then south over the hazy blue coast as if present to a wide future. Remember the way you are all possibilities you can see, and how you live best as an appreciator of horizons, whether you reach them or not. Admit that once you have got up from your chair and opened the door, once you have walked out into the clean air toward the edge and taken the path up high beyond the ordinary, you have become the privileged and the pilgrim. The one who will tell their story, and the one coming back from the mountain who helped make it. This is recreation. It is our opportunity. It is the call of our spiritual practice and the quest of our faith. It is the path by which we live the life of our best selves. To see ourselves as privileged and pilgrim, and to realize coming back from the mountain that we helped create it. So may you see this day and this pledge drive as your opportunity to partner with one another, to give meaningfully for those whom you don't yet know and may never meet, wanting for their path to be easier than yours has been, to plant cottonwood trees, for those to follow, because you know you'll want others to find the same freedom and possibility and love you have already found in this community. So may it be. All my relations, Shanti. Shalom. Amen.